This is the second edition of Introduction to Isaiah. And I realize I really let you down last week in spot right here next to Justin. But there's some historical stuff I should have led you through. We talked about what is a prophet. And I'm not talking like a prophet lost statement. That's not what I'm talking about. A prophet is the best way I could define a prophet is a mouthpiece for God. God is speaking through the mouth of a man. It doesn't have to do as much with telling the future, though he does. It's telling the people what he expects, calling them generally, calling them back to the righteousness that they had abandoned. And I want to read I'll read something here from 2 Chronicles 24, and I'll start in verse 17. It's just jumping into the history of Israel or Judah, actually. But after the death of Jehoiada, that was the high priest, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. And so the officials of Judah now have gotten into the ear of the king instead of the high priest in the ear of the king. And so instead of continuing to listen to the counsel the high priest had given him, which would be in his mind, he started listening to the officials. And they abandoned, verse 18, and they abandoned the house of Yahweh, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their guilt. Yet he sent prophets to them to bring them back to Yahweh. Though they testified against them, they would not listen. You see how important that verse 19 tells you everything you need to know about what a prophet was. God sent prophets to people who were straying from him to bring them back to him. Now that message would include, here's where you're going wrong. Here's what you need to do to correct it. If you don't correct it, wrath will come from God upon you. But like Jeremiah 29, 11, says, I know the plans I have for you to give you a future and a hope, even though I'm whooping the tar out of you as I send you into captivity. I still have plans for your future. The prophets would speak to those plans too. See? They would tell Israel, here's what I'm going to do in the future. But for the most part, he sent them prophets to bring them back to Yahweh, and they wouldn't listen. That's the primary function of a prophet. And that's what we tried to establish last week. And then I found this verse in my daily readings that that's what I was trying to say right there. That right there is what I was trying to say. So write that one down and keep it close to you, because that tells you what God intended for a prophet to be. Now,
Rod,
Isaiah, yes, Mike.
what was that verse again? First Chronicles?
2 Chronicles 24. I started with verse 17, but the focal verse is 19, 24, 19. It says, they would not listen. Let me continue reading. Then the Spirit of God came on Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest. So this would be the high priest's son. And he stood above the people and said to them, so this is the son of the man the king had been listening to. He's died. Now he's listening to the counselors, and they're abandoning God. So the high priest's son stands up and says, and the Holy Spirit upon him, and said to them, thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of Yahweh and don't prosper? Because you have forsaken Yahweh, he has also forsaken you. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of Yahweh. That's a pretty good response to hearing something you don't want to hear, don't you think? That's as ancient as it can be and as modern as last week. When you hear something you don't want to hear, just kill the prophet or kill the spokesman. Anyway, and the point I really wanted to make is when they listened to God's prophets, they would prosper. In fact, on that point, 2 Chronicles 20, and verse 20. Now, you can go establish the context on this. I'm not going to do that here. But verse 20 is, again, a real good standalone. In its context, it says the same thing as if we just grabbed it out of its context. And they rose early in the morning, that is, the Levites and the Kohathites and the sons of Korah, and stood up, verse 19, stood up to praise Yahweh, God of Israel, with a very loud voice. And they rose early in the morning and went out to the wilderness of Tekoa. And when they went out, Jehoshaphat stood, that's the king, Jehoshaphat the king, and said, "Listen to me, O Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem, put your trust in Yahweh your God, and you will be established. Put your trust in his prophets and succeed." And so hopefully that'll give you a sense of the purpose of the prophets, the heart of God in sending the prophets, and what God wanted to do for this people. Unfortunately, as you saw in the case of Jehoiada the priest and his son Zechariah, the people were not willing to listen. It wasn't the message they wanted to hear, so they killed him. Now, that gives a little bit of insight into the degenerative nature of Judah at this time. So what I want to do with you tonight, it's going to be going to this page here that says Introduction, Isaiah Introduction Part 1. I handed it out last week. Do you have that, Mike?
Yes.
Okay. And don't worry about the location. We talked about that. You do want to keep in mind the locale of the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian. Those were the biggies in the days. In fact, Daniel, remember Daniel's metal man image in chapter 2 of Daniel? It had the head of gold and the chest and arms of silver and the belly and thighs of brass and then bronze, and then the legs and feet of brass and iron and clay. And so the head was Babylon, the chest was Medo-Persia. And so those were the biggies that they dealt with. They weren't yet contending with the Grecian Empire, Alexander, or the Roman Empire, which came up in the about 100 years before Jesus. They weren't yet dealing with those. So they knew of Babylon. They knew the Medo-Persians. They knew the Assyrians. Here's a really interesting thing, and we'll get it when we get into Isaiah. But in chapter 12 and 13, is actually beginning at chapter 10, Isaiah is directing his attention to the Assyrian Empire, calling them the axe that God was using to cut stuff down with. But then he transmutes almost seamlessly into talking about the Babylonian Empire. It's like the one just kind of blended into the other as far as the impact upon God's people was concerned. And we'll see that here. We have... So in the book of Isaiah, really, though he's dealing at the time of the Assyrian Empire, he's really focusing on the Babylonian Empire and what they would do, because that's the empire. Assyria took the 10 northern tribes captive. 100 years later, Babylon took the 2 southern tribes, Judah, whose capital was Jerusalem, where the temple was. Babylon took them 100 years later. Isaiah is primarily focused upon the termination of the temple and the establishment of the new heavens, a new earth, at the time of the servant. Next week, I'm going to have go through a lot of the stuff that we'll be looking for, themes and so forth in the book of Isaiah. This week, we're going to be talking about primarily 2 Kings 15, 16, and 17, and the historical buildup to the days of Isaiah. So we have, at the time of Isaiah, Assyria was already established historians will call it Neo-Assyria, because there was an ancient Assyrian empire that went into disrepair, but then from the same general area hundreds of years later, a new Assyrian empire under a fellow by the name of Tiglath-Pileser III, also known in the Bible as Pul, Pul. Assyria rose to power. They were brutal. They were fierce. They were rapacious. Pictograms show them leading their captives on chains with hooks through their nose or anywhere else, naked, didn't matter if it was man or woman. They were brutal. And they would as soon see an old man begging for mercy to skewer him with a sword, or a pregnant woman asking for compassion and take a sword and slit her belly and let her fetus fall on the ground. That's the nature of the mindset of the Assyrian people, of the Assyrian army at the time that we're talking about here. I don't want to get too graphic, but they were brutal. They came to power, like you said, under Tiglath-Pileser. But with the defeat of Sennacherib, which Jeremiah deals with in chapters 37, 8, and 9, with the defeat of Sennacherib, you remember the 185,000 soldiers that died overnight because of the God's angel, because Hezekiah and Isaiah put their confidence in Yahweh rather than hiring some other foreign army. 185,000 of Sennacherib's soldiers died when he went back home. His sons, two of his sons, killed him, and a third son then took over as king. But that was the beginning of the collapse of Assyria. 100 years later, Babylon was able to just destroy them. In this, I found this interesting. Egypt decided that with Assyria as weak, you know where Egypt is on your map there, down in the south, below Jerusalem, they realized that the Assyrians were weak, and they thought, we will come and take over. King Josiah of Judah said, I don't want that. And so he went out and tried to stop it, and he died in that battle. And so for temporarily, the Egyptians took over Jerusalem. But Pharaoh Necho continued north to fight against the Assyrian. But what was that guy's name? Nebuchadnezzar was the son of the emperor or the king of Babylon. He had already defeated the Assyrian, and so instead of meeting a weak Assyrian army, Pharaoh met a strong Babylonian army, and he got his butt kicked all the way back down to Egypt. And in the process, if you're up north at Carchemish and you come back down to get to Egypt, you have to go right through, what's the name of that city? Jerusalem. Got to go right through Jerusalem to get there. And so on his way back, he just took Daniel and some other people as tokens of, I'm the boss now. And so that was around 609, 60, yeah, somewhere in that 606, 609, somewhere in that general neighborhood. Anyway, that was the transition that we're going to read of as we go from Isaiah 10 to Isaiah 13. We're going to see that transition from, we're not going to see the war. We're just going to see it. Isaiah talking about the Assyrian, talking about how God was going to cut them down, and then talking about the Babylonians. So we'll see that transition as we get in there. Go ahead.
I just didn't realize that the Battle of Carchemish, I didn't realize that Pharaoh was ex going expecting Assyria. I knew about the Battle of
Yeah.
Carchemish, but I didn't
He
realize
was expecting Assyria. He found Babylon.
Babylon. Didn't know that.
Yeah. And that's why Isaiah 19, okay, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud. It is Nebuchadnezzar's horses. And he came down and kicked Tar out of Egypt. Okay. So interesting stuff. It's just all meshes. But if you get this background, historic background. I mean, the Bible didn't take place in a vacuum. It took place in real life history, just like the events that have been going on this last week have not taken place in a vacuum. They've taken place in the culture with the you've got Russia and Ukraine over there. You got China doing what it's doing, and you've got all in Israel and Gaza. You got all this stuff going on, and then Charlie Kirk gets killed. He didn't get killed in a vacuum. He got killed in a whole stew of philosophic mindset. The Old Testament, the prophets did not take place in a vacuum either. You got all this stuff going on. Pharaoh thinking, I'm going to be boss now. And the Assyrian getting their tail kicked by Nebuchadnezzar. And then so did the Egyptians. And so did the, there wasn't a battle at Jerusalem. There was just a surrender. Pharaoh was in charge. Nebuchadnezzar took over. He took Daniel and Shadrach. No, he didn't take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He took Azariah, Hananiah, and Mishael, didn't he? That's who he took. And then renamed them once he got them there. Gave them Babylonian names. Anyway, that's the history in which all of this takes place. So why would God let Assyria and Babylon, why would he let them take his people into captivity?
Because they broke the covenant.
Because they broke the covenant, Michael says. You remember what we read over here in 2 Chronicles 24:19? Call them back to the, and they wouldn't come when the high priest's son said, this is why you're failing, they killed him. That's why. Okay? But we're gonna look at more things. So we've got Assyria, we've got Egypt, we've got Babylon. But those were distant nations. I mean, how far is China from the United States or Russia? Or do we have any close neighbors like Mexico or Canada or Guatemala? We got close neighbors too. Israel had a bevy of close neighbors. Syria, for example, whose capital was Damascus, Phoenicia, the Philistine countries, Moab, Edom, Ammon, small nations that surrounded Judah and were the major protagonists or antagonists during Judah's history until the big guy in the east decided to rise up and sweep through and take them all. But these smaller nations were also part of Israel's experience. Part of her experience. Okay? Let's go to 2 Kings now. We're going to look at some things in chapter 15, some things in chapter 16. I left the paper I wrote all this stuff down on at home, which is my fault and my problem. But in verse 8, in the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam. Now, this is the second Jeroboam that was king over Israel. There was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that was the first guy. And then there's this Jeroboam. The one, the guy that took over when the 10 tribes left was Jeroboam. This guy was, who was the son, the promise was made that he would have, I think it was Jehu, king of Israel. You'd have four generations. And this guy was the fourth, the end of it. Anyway, in the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel in Samaria for how long? For 6 months. He did evil. He didn't depart. And then verse 10, Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him, struck him before the people and killed him. And he reigned in his place. How long did he reign? Verse 13, he reigned 1 month. Now, what's going on when somebody kills the king and he gets to reign for, what did we say, 6 months? Somebody kills him and he reigns for 1 month. What's going on?
Lives, civilization.
High turnover. Why is there high turnover? That's part of it. But that's not the major part of it. Bad leadership, Rachel said.
Collapse of moral morality.
Yeah. The collapse of respect for authority, power grab. Society in general is in a turmoil. Okay? Society in general. Chapter 15 is showing the foment in society. There was one king that got to reign actually for, I think, 11 years in this period of time. But you go through this and see king after king after king after king. And some of them are just a couple years, 11 years, two months, 8 months. And you've got what I'm trying to picture, help you see, is that at this time, at the time that we're dealing with, the 10 northern tribes were so corrupted in their thinking that they weren't following Yahweh. Had they been following Yahweh, society would have been stable. But I don't like him telling me what to do. The only reason God tells us what to do is because we can't figure it out on our own. And he wants us to have a good, stable life. Following him. See? Listen, what did we read in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 20? Follow Yahweh your God and prosper. I listen to his prophets and succeed. He wants you to prosper. You quit following him, you're on your own. What is it that Jeremiah said? It is not in man that walks to do what? It is not in man that walks to direct his own steps. And what is it that Solomon said in Proverbs? There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is death. Anytime we quit listening to Yahweh and try to figure out life on our own, we're going to end up failing.
So it says God gave them over to a reprobate mind.
Yeah, when they gave up on God, God gave them over. Let them. I'm not going to force my will upon you. That would cease to be free will, right? That would cease to be free will. So if you want to do it that way, I'm going to let you do it that way, because the other would be me forcing my will on you. I won't do that. But he gave them over. He gave them over. He gave them over. So we have a society in decay, because we want to put God not just on the back burner, we want to throw God out with the garbage. And when you see that going on in our society, you better perk up your ears. Here's God historically describing what happened in a society that decided they didn't really need God to guide them. Man is not in man that walks to direct his own steps. He's going to step in it. You're going to make a mess. And so chapter 15 is looking at the societal mess that comes about. Okay. Now, in chapter 16, I would have you parallel chapter 16 with Isaiah 7. I'll show you why here. In 17th year, Pekah, son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, became king. So, not going to worry about him, but we are, right? Because he is the king that's addressed in Isaiah 7. Ahaz, the king that Isaiah addresses in chapter 7. But Pekah, the son of Remaliah, he was king of Israel. And he conspired with Rezin. Where's Rezin? Down to verse 5. It says, then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war. You know why they did that? Pekah and Rezin, king of Israel and king of Syria, just thought they'd wage war against the king of Judah. And Alan, the reason they did that is because Ahaz, king of Judah, would not form a league with them to go and fight Assyria. And so you're not going to help us fight Assyria. We're going to kick you out, put somebody else in. That was there. You'll read that in Isaiah 7. We want to put somebody else in so that we can go together against the king of Assyria. You know what Isaiah told Ahaz at this time? Trust God. Trust God. These guys, they're just powder puffs. In a couple of years, they'll be gone. Just trust God. But you know what Ahaz did instead?
He went to Assyria.
He hired Assyria to help him against those two guys. Guess what happens when you hire Assyria to come in and fight your battle for you?
They
I
want
got
to
them.
fight back.
I got them. I'm going to go get the Philistines and the Ammonites and the Moabites. And oh, by the way, why not you too? I'll come in. I'll wage war against you as well. And so Ahaz just he just opened up the floodgates for the Assyrian invasion. That's all he did. He didn't trust God, who promised him that would that by the time that a little boy could know right from wrong, these two guys would be gone. How long does it take for an infant to learn right from wrong? How long does that take? Not even that. Timmy knows right from wrong. He just turned 7, 5, 6 years. So he was promised that just within that lifespan, these guys that you're worried about would be gone. They're nothing. Trust me. I'll trust the king of Assyria instead. And so he just, opened Pandora's box. And the king of Assyria came in, and you know the rest of it. In verse 9, it says, so the king of Assyria listened to him, and the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, that would be Rezin, and captured it and carried it away and put Rezin to death. And then the king of Damascus and King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saw the altar. Oh, I like that altar. Let's get an altar like that one and bring it back down to the temple, and we'll just really have something going on. So, chapter 16 is a chapter which details or sketches, it's not detailed, it's sketchy, thumbnail sketches of the lack of faith that the kings of Judah, the king Ahaz of Judah, had in Yahweh's ability to deliver them. Put your trust in Yahweh and you will succeed. He didn't do that. And so that's what began the demise. Isaiah said, trust him, but he hired Assyria instead. Now, beginning in Isaiah 37, 8, and 9, we have the same story repeated that we have here in chapter 18 of, or 17, I'm sorry, chapter 17 and 18 of, actually, I'm wrong on the dates. It's 18 and 19. It's the Assyria. The Tiglath-Pileser is gone, but this now it's Sennacherib leading invasion against Samaria. What is Samaria? Some length times some distance.
Capital. It's the capital of the Northern Kingdom.
Yeah, it's the capital of the Northern Kingdom. Hola. Come on in. Just find a place, any place. Good to have you again. We're just doing a review, the historical review leading up to the writing of Isaiah. So we've been looking at 2 Kings 15, 2 Kings 16, and now 2 Kings 17, along with 17, 18, 19, along with Jeremiah, Isaiah 37, 8, and 9. It's repeating the story. Okay. Samaria is the capital city of the 10 northern tribes, just kind of like Washington, D.C. is the capital city of the United States of America. And what was it for the Canadian provinces?
The country
The capital city?
of Canada
Uh-huh.
is Ottawa.
Ottawa. Ottawa. Okay. And so on and on you go. Samaria was the capital city of that nation, 10 northern tribes. And so it says that, where did I read it? Where did I read it? I lost my place. Anyway, The Sennacherib, king of Assyria, went on an invasion. That's where I was. He first of all invaded Samaria, and then you know how many walled cities were in Judah. Now Judah's the two southern tribes. About the Judah could be from the top of the Dead Sea due west of the Mediterranean, from the bottom of the Dead Sea due west. That would be Judah. Judah and Benjamin. How many walled cities do you suppose they had? 42. 42 walled cities. Why wall up a city?
It's a bastion.
Yeah, it's a protection. You got all kinds of little villages out doing the, I mean, they're reaping, planting the crops, reaping the crops, just little villages. But if there's an invasion of an invading army, they could go to the walled city in their district and have some protection. There are 42 of them. I've told you about the obelisk. It's not called an obelisk. It's called a prism. It's about 13 inches high and about 6 inches wide, and there are six sides to it. It's a clay prism that Sennacherib recorded his exploits on. The actual one that he wrote on is in a museum in Chicago, and I've seen it with my own eyes. I got a picture of it over there. But it's called Sennacherib's Prism, and he says on that prism, I had Hezekiah, king of Judah, pinned in like a bird in a cage. Okay, so you'll read that in here. The invasion and the serious threats. We're going to go through this when we get into 37, 8, and 9. So I'm not going to go into any details. But he would send messengers. He's off fighting down at Lachish. But he would send messengers. They don't let Hezekiah tell you to trust in Yahweh, because how many of the surrounding nations trusted in their God, and I obliterated them, and I'll do the same to you. Don't let your king tell you to trust in a God that can't deliver you. And that was the message that they were hearing. But there are two people of utmost importance. One of them was named Hezekiah the king. He was a righteous man. He did trust Yahweh. And there was Isaiah the prophet. So it's one of my favorite stories in the whole Bible. Hezekiah got a note from the king. I'm coming your way. You might as well just surrender. Don't put your trust in Yahweh. All the other nations put their trust in their God, and they all fell to me, and you're going to be like that. Even Samaria fell to me. Hezekiah took that letter, and he went into the house of God, and he laid that letter out before God, and he prayed over it. The beautiful prayer. We'll read it when we get there.
The letter is just so disrespectful to God.
Oh, it's horribly disrespectful. And so Hezekiah prayed. Isaiah came to him and says, God heard your prayer. That guy's not even going to throw up a siege mound against you. And the way he came, that's the way he's going to go back. And that night, 185,000 of his men died in their tents. And he hightailed it back to Assyria, Nineveh, and his sons killed him. Okay, so look at 2 Kings 19 with me. I want to look at 7 verses. 2 Kings 19, actually 8 verses, 21 through 28. Now, when we get into chapter 39, a year from now, we'll read it again. By then it'll have the dust of other thoughts on top of it. This is, and so verse 20, then Isaiah the son of Amoz sent to Hezekiah saying, see, because Hezekiah prayed about this letter. Sent to Hezekiah saying, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. This is the word that Yahweh has spoken against him. She has despised you and mocked you, the virgin daughter of Zion, i.e. Jerusalem. She has shaken her head. That the she here is Assyria. She has shaken her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? And against whom have you raised your voice and haughtily lifted your eyes? Against the Holy One of Israel. Wasn't just a nation that was tenuous. Wasn't just the king on the throne. It was against the Holy One of Israel. Through your messengers, you have reproached the Lord. And you have said, with my many chariots, I came up to the heights of the mountains, to the remotest parts of Lebanon, and cut down its tall cedars. Cut down its tall cedars is code for what? Cutting down the kings. Cutting down the kings of all the nations. We'll see that, language in chapter 10 of Isaiah. Cut down all its tall cedars, its choice cypresses, and I entered its farthest lodging places, its thickest forest. I dug and drank foreign waters, and with the sole of my feet, I dried up all the rivers of Egypt, i.e. I got across any river that was in my way. And so that's what Yahweh said that the Assyrian king was bragging about. Here's his response. Have you not? Long ago, I did it. When we get into Isaiah 45, 40 through 44, 45, we're going to see this argument developed. I announced these things a long time ago. From ancient times, I planned it. Now I have brought it to pass that you should turn fortified cities into ruinous heaps. I planned for you, Sennacherib, to do those things. It was my plan, not yours. When we get to chapter 10, God is going to say to the king, what are you bragging about? That'd be like the axe bragging about against the one who's wielding the axe. No, powerful axe. But no, the powerful man used the axe. God said, I'm the powerful man, you're the axe. All right. I brought it to pass that you should turn fortified cities into ruinous heaps. Therefore, their inhabitants were short of strength. They were dismayed and put to shame. They weren't weary because of your prominence. They were weary because I determined that that would be the case. They were as the vegetation of the field and as the herb, the green herb, as grass on the housetops that scorch before it grows up. But I know you're sitting down and you're going out and you're coming in and you're raging against me. I know that. I know what you're doing. I know what you're thinking in your heart. Because of your raging against me, and because your arrogance has come up to my ears, therefore I will put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. That's what God said to Sennacherib. That night, 185,000 of his men died in their tents, and he went back home, and his sons killed him. Down to verse 37, it came about as he, Sennacherib, was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, being in his place. Now, those two guys were his sons that did that. So that's kind of the trauma, the drama, the intrigue that's going on, the turmoil among the nations that was going on at the time that Isaiah was called upon to preach to Israel, to preach to Judah. Okay? Now, I want you to remember, I'm on page 2 now of these notes, and that we've talked about, we've talked about the prophets, what they are, specifically the context of the time which we've just developed. Assyria was a threat to national security. Assyria was a threat to national existence. And there were three distinct ways to deal with it. Number one was to give up, called the Assyria. I mean, this was it within the nation. Here's what we should do. And so there was this party of let's accede to their wishes. Let's just give up. There was a party, let's enlist Egypt for help. And there was a very small party that says, let's trust Yahweh. And that's what's going on within Jerusalem at this time. The work of Isaiah was to promote trust in Yahweh. When we get to chapter 40, 41, 42, Isaiah is going to say, what God among the gods Can you compare it to Yahweh? And you're going to find a spectacular argument in there. Amazing argument. I'll wait till we get there to develop it, but he's challenging the gods that Israel is afraid of to step and do what their God has already done and will do again. Let's make a comparison to see which God can follow through. There's some great stuff in there, and I don't want to spoil it. Spoiler alert, no. So where on your map, if you want to appeal to your map, it would be a good thing to do. But as you look at the greater Mediterranean region, and in fact, not just the Mediterranean, but off to the east, where is Jerusalem in relationship to all that? Right on all the crossroads. Anything that came in from Rome or Greece came in by ship to Tel Aviv, we call it Tel Aviv now, Haifa. They come in there. And anything coming from the east, Syria, not Syria, I didn't mean to say Syria, Medo-Persia, anything from there would come across Carchemish, the pass at Carchemish, and come right on down, either through past the coast, or there was a King's Highway that was just on the east of the Dead Sea. But all traffic went through, and if you're coming from Egypt, you have to go through Europe. God said, what prophet was it? I think it was Jeremiah chapter 5, I think it was. It says, I put you in the center of the nations. I placed you, and it's like I placed you as a light right there where everybody had to pass through. So you consider where she was. She's a prime area for influencing people to know about their God. That's what God intended. I want you to be a light to the nations. I want the nations to realize what a great God you have. Look over here in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Come back with me to Deuteronomy 4. And starting in verse 1, really. We'll get there. Here we go. And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you to perform in order that you may go and that you may live and go in and take possession of the land which Yahweh, your God of your fathers, is giving you. Now, back in Leviticus 19, he says, if you do what they did, you're going to get what they got. You're going to get kicked out just like they did. So I'm giving you statutes that you can live, that you can go in and occupy and stay there. You shall not add to the word, verse 2, which I am commanding you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of Yahweh your God, which I command you. Your eyes have seen what Yahweh has done in the case of Baal Peor. For all the men who followed Baal Peor, Yahweh your God destroyed them from among you. Then they started going with idolatry. God wiped them out. You've seen what he thinks about that. Okay, you've seen that. But you held fast to Yahweh your God. You who held fast to Yahweh your God are alive here today, every one of you. Oh, if I follow the idols, I die. If I follow Yahweh, I live. Clear lesson, right? Yeah, clearly. Okay, verse 5. See, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as Yahweh my God commanded me. That's Moses talking. That you should do thus in the land where you are entering to possess it. So keep and do, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as Yahweh our God whenever we call on him? Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as the whole law which I'm setting before you today? And so I think of the privilege that Israel had. Not only the location where they could be the barter hub of the world. Now what happens if you're the barter hub? Every time there's a sale of something, you get a piece of it. It's a place to grow exceedingly wealthy. But also a distribution hub for the wisdom that God put in his word. They had that. They had a covenant with God. What it mean to have a, what does it mean to have covenant with God? I will be your God. You will be my people. If I'm your God, or as Jesus said in Luke 6, verse 46, why do you call me Lord, Lord? And don't do what I say. There's the implication that if he's my God, I'll follow him implicitly. But you're my people. What is that? What's the implication there? You're my people. You're my people. Nobody's going to get to you. I will protect you. I'll provide for you. I'll guide you. I'll deliver you. You're my people. The apple of my eye. Covenant. The privilege of Israel was great. They had law, made them wise. Did you know that when Israel came out of Egypt, that one of the things that Egypt, one of the medical practices, established, documented medical practice, if you got a sliver or something, you put donkey dung on it to pull that thing out as a poultice. Does that sound healthy to you? That was the accepted standard medical practice. God had in his law, here's what you do in this case, here's what you do in that, just talking about the medical things. Wow. And so just whatever you want to talk about medical, you want to talk about hygiene, you want to talk about diet, you want to talk about government, you want to talk about interpersonal relationship, everything God said was wise and for the benefit of the longevity of the country. So Israel had great privilege, but they also didn't listen to these wise words of Moses. There are basically four areas that God expects of any nation. He expects them to be economically righteous. Commerce should be fair, just. Just measures, just weights. The treatment of people. What did Jesus say? As you want to be treated, treat others. God expected compassionate, even-handed treatment of people. So you got your you got your commerce, you got your society. We all live in a body that has desires. God expected his people to be morally above board, morally sound, sexually sound, and religiously sound. So you've got the society, which would include government. You've got commerce, which would include all kinds of greed. You have interaction between humans as far as their passions, and you have interactions with God. I want people in any nation to be economically healthy, to be morally healthy, to be governmentally healthy, and to be spiritually healthy. Those are the bases upon which God holds a nation accountable. And Israel had failed in all of them. Each man neighing lustfully after his neighbor's wife, one of the prophets said. Dishonest scales, distorted measures. You know why it's called a fifth of liquor? You know why it's called a fifth? It used to be a quart. But the liquor makers would put that bubble in the bottom, makes it look like a quart, but it's only 4/5 of a quart or 1/5 of a gallon. And so they had to start labeling it for what it was. But it got that way because the makers of the alcohol were trying to cheat the buyers of the alcohol, making them think they're getting more than they got. Okay? And self-gratifying, brutal. I don't care what happens to you. And why did that guy shoot Charlie Kirk? Why did he do it? Because he didn't like what he was saying. And that, I mean, plain and simple. I know that's really simplified. It that take leaves a lot of the context of society out of it. But basically, I don't like what you're saying. Here's my bullet. I don't have to give you a shoot. When a society gets like that, God does something. And that's a thing that is going on. And spiritually, I have a book in my library. It's called Why Scientists Accept Evolution. The bottom line is, you know why scientists accept evolution? Go back to the founding fathers, Huxley and some of those guys. And in their writings, when Darwin came up with the hypothesis, I'm not even going to call it a theory. It's not strong enough to call it a theory of evolution. All these guys said, now we have an alternative explanation other than the Bible of how we got here. And we don't like the moral code of the Bible, so let's throw it out. That's why they accept evolution. Not because it's factually substantiated by science. It's not. But because it allows them to get rid of a moral standard that they don't want to keep. And that's why people abandon the guidance of God, because they don't get the life they want to live. They would rather have a self-determined lifestyle. Enjoy it while you can, because it's going to take you down. There is a way that seems right, but its end is death. It's not a man that walks to guide his steps. I need somebody who can see the bigger picture that I can't see, and that's God. And so we had Israel and Judah with a great deal of privilege, position to get filthy rich, to spread the good news of God, a position that was highly defensible, a law that taught them wisdom that the ages hadn't come to. And they abandoned all that, because they didn't like to live the restricted life. Saying no to self is not a fun thing to do sometimes, but it's always the wise thing to do. It's always the healthy thing to do. It's always the upward thing to do. And so, because they chose to abandon God, Romans 2, right? Because they chose to abandon God, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. His protection was with them. Since you have chosen not to listen to me, I will be your God, you will be my people. Since you've chosen not to listen to me, I'll let you be on your own. I remove my protection from you. There's this beautiful thought in Zechariah 2 that at the time that Jerusalem was restored, not for Zechariah, by the time of Zechariah, they'd already rebuilt the temple. By the time that the real Jerusalem is restored, it will be just burgeoning with people. He says, don't measure the walls. The Jerusalem is going to have so many people and animals that the walls won't hold it. I will be a wall of fire about her. I will be her protection. But woe be to that nation who says we don't need God. They don't need God's protection either, then, do they? They're on their own. And I tell you, Sennacherib represented a brutal mindset, a rapacious mindset, one that didn't care, as we already saw, one that didn't care about children, didn't care about old people, didn't care about pregnant women, didn't care. I'm taking you. And when God's people abandon him, he let them come in. Isaiah and the others, but Isaiah, who's we're concerned about, Isaiah came on the scene to call people back to God so that it didn't have to happen. That's what we're going to see. That's a historical background for the message of Isaiah. I've shared a few snippets of where they come into the book. As we went through this historical survey. Next week, we'll open the book up and see its parts and its pieces and its construction and instruction, what to expect here and there. And we'll look at some You want to pass these up? We'll look at some of the key or major themes that Isaiah develops in his book. Any thoughts, questions, comments, observations, objections, rebuttals?
So I just read Nahum.
Nahum.
Is that, now is that the defeat just before Carchemish?
I don't know. I'd have to, you know more than I do about that. I mean, you just read Nahum.
Just read it.
So here's one thing I want to say about Nahum. Short little prophet. Do not misunderstand the name. It's not Hoham. It is flashing chariots and speeding stuff. It's anything but a Hoham book. Did I not make enough? All right. I've got this one. Well, it's a mean one, but who else in here didn't get one?
I need to take a picture of mine. That is the digital stuff. And yeah, this one.
So great. It looks like we don't need any.
Linda needs one. I knew. So just one more.
I don't get it now.
If she doesn't get it now, she's probably not going to get it at all. Anyway, that's what I had for you for tonight.